Now, the state attorney and the attorneys working in the office of the state attorney and its branches perform work on behalf of the government of the republic, which is by law normally performed by attorneys, notaries and conveyancers. Now, the need to amend the Act emanates basically from the framework for the transformation of state legal services, which was released in May 2012 by our minister. Now, as the committee may be aware, the transformation of the state legal services is not an isolated event. It forms part of a much broader transformation exercise relating to the administration of justice, which also includes the transformation of the legal profession via the legal practices and also the institutional reforms relating to the judiciary, which served before this committee and other parliamentary committees recently. Now, the policy deals with, and I'm talking now about the framework actually, and the framework deals with the criteria of certain concerns that have been expressed in the past about how state legal services are provided. And the idea in terms of the transformation framework is then to say how to rectify these challenges. Now, the concerns raised and that are dealt with in the framework deals with the fragmented approach to the management of state litigation and for also challenges relating to the briefing of previously disadvantaged individuals. And these factors, we believe, hamper state legal services and they are all identified in the framework. And if I can just refer to a few, and the need to refer to that is to make sure that we touch on these aspects when we deal with the proposed amendment. The one is the lack of effective coordination of legal services. And this gives rise to certain operational challenges, Chairperson, such as the prescription of claims where government is involved. Also, default judgments granted against government, that is where government does not object or in reply to the claim, submit any claim or defense. Then also, punitive court orders arising out of inefficiencies in the office of the state attorney and inconsistencies in the determination of advocacy. Another important aspect that the framework deals with is the lack of a framework providing for the sourcing of legal work and allocating briefs to law firms and advocates, resulting in over-reliance on private briefs and thereby depleting the fiscus and briefs also not being awarded on an equitable basis. Then there's also the lack of internal capacity and expertise in the state legal services, but particularly in specialist areas of the law. Now, government also loses court cases it ought not to have lost, or embarking on what we call ill-fated litigation, where alternative forms of dispute resolution was available to address the litigation, and that in instances where such a dispute resolution mechanism would have been more appropriate. Now, having regard to all the challenges in this regard, the framework identifies a number of fundamental principles, and they are the following: the Constitution's imperative, reforming of outdated legislative framework, the beefing up of governance and intergovernmental relations, effective consolidation and coordination, and then very importantly, specialization and enhanced capacity. Then also what is important is, having regard to these principles, the framework seeks to achieve the following objectives. First of all, the consolidation and coordination of state legal services, firstly within our department and thereafter the across government, so as to ensure institutional efficiency. the establishment of an interface with other departments, organs of state, provinces, and local governments to improve coordination of the state legal services. Then enhancing capacity of the state to manage its litigation effectively and economically, and then building and enhancing specialization within the state legal services in order to contribute meaningfully in the evolving jurisprudence locally, on the continent, and globally. Now, Chairperson, the implementation of the framework consists of various elements and various phases, one of which only is the amendment of the State Attorney Act. And as an initial step in this process and as a first step in changing the State Attorney Act, the bill has been introduced. Now, the approach that we have followed was to tamper as little as possible with the provisions of the Act. At the later stage, the Act will be reviewed in order to, among others, implement other aspects of the framework and to modernize the current legislative framework. Now, the main objectives of the bill are to amend the State Attorney Act to provide for the following: the establishment of more than one office of state attorney, so that all of them will have equal status as opposed to the current statutory arrangement of one office of a state attorney, which is located in Pretoria, and then branch offices thereof. Secondly, is we seek to make provision for the appointment of more than one state attorney to head the offices of state attorney, whereas now there is only one state attorney and only other attorneys in charge of the branch offices. We want to give effect to the proposed amendment in that more than one state attorney can be appointed. Then also to make provision for the appointment of a number of attorneys to perform the legal work in the offices of the state attorney. But very importantly, we also would like to see the appointment and the powers and functions of a solicitor general who will be the executive head of all the state attorneys. And this person will exercise control and supervision other the offices of state attorney. Now, the appointment of a person as head of all the state attorney's chair and the attorneys who are employed in the different offices and who are performing legal work on behalf of government is proposed with a view to, among others, improving efficiency in the provision of legal services to the state and to enhance accountability. And then the bill also seeks to confer certain powers on the minister, and these powers relate to the functions of the offices of state attorney. The term solicitor general I'll discuss in more detail now. It suffice at this stage to say that the solicitor general will be the state's chief legal advisor in all civil litigation, similar to the role of the National Director of Public Prosecution in criminal matters. The amendments relate to the appointment chair of a functionary, meaning a person. With the bill before the committee, we don't envisage a whole structure or an office. It's only the appointment of a functionary. The appointment of this functionary and the other proposed amendments contained in the bill, as I've indicated, should be seen as an initial step in the implementation of the framework to which I refer. Now, if we can go clause by clause analysis, the first clause is, the purpose of the first clause is then to replace the existing Office of the State Attorney established in Pretoria and the branches of that office with offices of state attorney, all of which will have equal status, and those offices may be established by the minister. This amendment will bring the legislation in line with the current situation in terms of which the present office of the state attorney in Pretoria and all the branches are operating. But of course, because there is existing office and branch offices, the clause also provides for a transitional arrangement to indicate what will happen with these offices if this law becomes an act. Then, if we can go to clause 2, basically, in terms of the Act presently, the Minister may appoint a person as a state attorney, and this person must meet certain criteria, and this person is then in charge of the office of the state attorney. And then, in addition, the Minister may appoint other persons to be in charge of any branch office of the office in the, of the state attorney, and then also any other persons that are required to perform the functions in those offices. Now, clause 2 therefore wants to substitute section 2 of the Act to provide for the appointment, but subject to the laws governing the public service, of the Solicitor General by the Minister, but who will, having regard to the ethical norms and standards in the attorney's profession, be subject to the direction and supervision of the Minister. Chair, the position of Head of State Legal Services, in our view, is similar to that of the Solicitor General in comparable jurisdiction. The term solicitor is used in other jurisdictions, and a solicitor is our equivalent of an attorney, and a barrister is our equivalent of an advocate. Now, clause 2 goes further to set out the appointment requirements for this head, namely the Solicitor General, which includes the following. First of all, the person must be a fit and proper person, and in determining that, the Minister must have regard to the person's experience, conscientiousness, and integrity. Furthermore, this person must either be an admitted attorney, or if he or she is not an admitted attorney, must be an admitted advocate, but in this instance, with previous experience as an attorney, and who must not have been struck off the roll of attorneys and advocates. Now, the term of office of the Solicitor General is also regulated in this clause, namely a term of 5 years, but which may be extended by the Minister for any further period of not more than 5 years at a time. Now, initially the view was held that the term of office of the Solicitor General must be a fixed term, like in the case of the NDPP, who is appointed for a term of 10 years, but which is not renewable. But however, later in the deliberations, the point was made that we need to make sure that the bill provides some form of discretion to the Minister and allow flexibility in order to ensure continuity in this office. Then also the bill in clause, by way of clause 2, provides for the appointment by the Minister of state attorneys, and the state attorneys will be in charge of the offices of state attorney. But it also provides for the appointment by the Minister of attorneys and other persons necessary to perform the work in the office of a state attorney. The appointment requirements for the state attorneys and the attorneys working in the offices of state attorney are the following. They must be fit and proper persons, and this requirement is also contained in section 10 of the Public Service Act, of course, because they are public servants in addition to the fact that they are attorneys, and also then they must be admitted attorneys. But this clause also allows the Solicitor General to have a say in the appointment of future incumbents in the offices of state attorney, and in particular in the appointment of the state attorney who will head the different offices of state attorney. Now, in terms of this clause, the Minister makes the appointment, but after the consultation with the Solicitor General. Then you will see that clause 2 also regulates the termination of the appointment of the Solicitor General, the state attorneys, and the attorneys performing the functions in the offices of state attorney. and the ground for termination and the process to be followed are in line with the laws governing the public service. Then lastly, what is of importance is that the clause also regulates acting appointments, indicating that the minister may, whenever the solicitor general's post is vacant, or whenever he or she is for any reason absent or unable to exercise his or her powers, to appoint a person who complies with the appointment requirements for solicitor general to act in the solicitor general's post for the period that the minister deems fit. And this clause likewise empowers the Solicitor General to appoint a person to act as a state attorney under similar circumstances. Now, also in clause 2 you will see there is a delegation power that not so as to not to burden the minister with administrative matters. Clause 2 enables the minister to delegate the appointment function relating to state attorneys, attorneys working in the offices of state attorney and other supporting staff to the Solicitor General. And then once again, as is the case in clause 1, in clause 2, we get a transitional arrangement to deal with the existing staff in the offices and to indicate that all of them will be deemed to be appointed in terms of the newly created structures and in terms of the act as amended. Then clause 3 change. Clause 3 of the bill amends section 3 of the act. It affects technical amendments in order to refer to the change relating to the offices of state attorney as opposed to the office of the state attorney and its branches. But it also corrects outdated reference. But what is of importance here is that there is a new subsection 4 and 5 that are included. Now in terms of this clause, the minister must, after consultation with the Solicitor General, who in turn must consult with the state attorney, determine policy relating to the functions of the offices of state attorney as set out in section 3 of the Act. And this policy must include the following aspects: the coordination and management of all litigation in which the state is involved, the briefing of advocates, the outsourcing of legal work, including the instruction of correspondent attorneys, initiating, defending and opposing of matters, and implementing alternative dispute resolution mechanisms in the resolution of litigation against the state. Chairperson, all these aspects are aspects referred to in the framework or as being aspects that are challenging and are hampering the rendering of state legal services. Now, the clause also requires that this policy, which will be determined by the minister, as well as any amendments thereto, must be approved by cabinet. And furthermore, it must be tabled in parliament. Now, it's not usual to find a requirement that cabinet must approve policy. In this instance, it was deemed fit to do so because of the fact that the policy will deal with the briefing of advocates by all state departments. And this will have implications on the existing position in terms of which the prevailing discretion of state departments in this regard may be affected, but always with the broader idea of making sure that previously disadvantaged individuals are appointed. Now, as a point of departure, we've had a look at Section 10 of the Promotion of Administrative Justice, in terms of which cabinet approval is also required, but that was in respect of the Code of Good Admin Conduct to be made by the minister, and which also has an impact on all the state departments. Now, the precedent for the requirement that the policy and amendments must be tabled in parliament, chairperson, can be found in more than one piece of legislation, namely section 21(2) of the National Prosecuting Authority Act, which requires the tabling of the prosecution policy in parliament, and then also in section 10(c) 6 of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, which requires that the Code of Good Ethical Conduct must be approved by Parliament. The next clause is Clause 4, and this clause sets out the powers and functions of the Solicitor General in a new proposed Section 3A. And it provides that the Solicitor General is the executive officer of all the offices of the State Attorney, and this person must exercise control over all the offices of State Attorney. And this wording has been taken from Section 2 of the Administration of Estates Act, which was amended in round about 2005 to provide that the Chief Master is in charge of all the Master's offices throughout the Republic. Then Clause 4 also empowers then the Solicitor General to implement the policy determined by the Minister as provided for in Section 3. And the Solicitor General must implement this policy by issuing directives and standards relating to the functions of the Office of State Attorney. And this is important because this will ensure uniformity and the provision of quality legal services. Now, Clause 4 also provides that the Solicitor General must exercise the powers and perform the functions and duties as determined in this Act, any other law, and in addition, perform any other function that may be required of him or her by the Minister. Now, the latter function has been provided for in Clause 4 in order to enable the Solicitor General to assist with the implementation of the framework, including the development of a framework for the amalgamation and streamlining of all components rendering state legal services as is envisaged in the framework. Now, in terms of this clause, the directives and the standards which must be issued by the Solicitor General must be tabled in Parliament by the Minister. And this provision was formulated taking into consideration other pieces of legislation which has been passed by Parliament over some time. First of all, if you look at Section 97 of the Child Justice Act, you will see that there is a requirement that the directives which must be issued by the NDPP must also be submitted to Parliament for approval. And then secondly, in the same Act, it's required that the national instruction to be issued by the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service must also be submitted to Parliament before a certain period. Now, the Solicitor General may, subject to any conditions as he or she may determine, in writing, delegate any of these or her powers, but of course that this person will not be divested of any powers so delegated and may amend or set aside any decision made by any delegate in the exercise of this power, but subject to any rights that may have accrued to a person as a result of the decision. But the Solicitor General is not empowered to delegate the function to issue the directives and the standards as part of the implementation of the policy formulated by the Minister. Chairperson, Clauses 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 and 10 are what we want to refer to as consequential technical amendments. Because we changed the one office and the branches to more than one office, this is what it seeks to affect and also to correct outdated references. Then Clause L, 11, and Clause 11 of the Bill amends the long title of the Act. Clause 12 provides for the short title and commencement. So what is envisaged, Chairperson, is that the amendments contained in the Bill which seek to implement specific aspects of the framework will provide an appropriate basis for ensuring that effective and cost-efficient state legal services is provided and that the provision of legal services to state organs is improved. It also lays the basis for the appointment of a Solicitor General as soon as circumstances permit. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, for that presentation. think it will allow honorable members to comment on the bill. Taking into consideration that the bill really has to go to the province. Honorable Lord.
No, thank you, Chair, I must just raise a concern before you even get to this, is that most of us are not the legal people here. And the presentation itself is so much of a summary of what is in the actual bill. But I would have liked, because we have to go to provinces and present this bill, if there was no better presentation of this in a way that it made simpler for us. We understand the content that is written, but I cannot go to a province and start talking the way it is summarized here. We would have been appreciated if you had a sort of a presentation that is step by step, that is showing all the issues that are summarized here, plot by plot. This is a summary more than the actual thing. Coming to the actual bill itself, I must say that I also want to get a clarity of the after, and you know, it's always explained, but I forget what actually this is, because it is said here that the minister, after consultation with the Solicitor General, must consult, in turn consult with state attorneys, determine policy relating to, example, functions of offices. Does that mean that the minister can consult with the Solicitor General, but take his own decision on that? Or is the advice that will be given in the consultation the final one? Maybe just the clarity of this after and with. The other thing that I may need to ask, on page 9 of your presentation, on 3.4.5, I am not very sure of what I hear there. If maybe in just the layman's language, he can come back and just explain, more especially when you see they have all those subject conditions determined in writing, delegate any power, and so on. And at the end, they say, however, not delegate power to issue directives and standards. Maybe if I can be clarified, what's the difference there? What is it that he can delegate power on, and what is it that he can't? As I said in my preamble, that we are not legal people, so we just want that. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Kuna. No? Is it more?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation firstly, yes? Chair, I've got a few questions. If this bill, this Solicitor General, is this office created to be efficient and effective for the privileged and disadvantaged people who don't have the finance muscle to be able to get someone, because the state attorneys sometimes are not available for all people on time? And the other thing is, the budget of this office is, will it be budgeted for from the department? And then, let me just get there. Brother also asked the one question. I was one very soon on the definition of powers, delegation of powers to certain people. On your objects of the bill 2.2, you said the main objects of the bill are to amend the Citizens Act so as to provide for the following. Just clear on the first one, to establish, okay, I understand, everyone knows not that one. Let me just see where is it. Okay, now I see Brother also on that question. Okay, it's fine, thank you.
Just one clarity. Is this process one to assist in bringing this bill in line with the bill that we have just passed that deals with the linking of the advocates and the attorneys? That's one specific area. That also assists in making sure that in one of the areas the bill that we have passed previously, the leakage of the proper working from the advocates and the magistrates, is this bill trying to deal with that particular situation and make sure that there is efficiency as my colleague is indicating in the legal project.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been covered by Honourable Gundo, but I would like to know in 3.2, they speak of certain criteria, a person who meets certain criteria. I think that needs to be expanded so that we have direct information on what this criteria is. And then with regard to Honourable Barutu, I would say that after consultation should be changed to in consultation. That makes it just more constitutionally correct. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mercy.
Thank you very much, Chair. Must apologize for being late, firstly. Secondly, I've just interacted with the document now, but throughout, because of Carolyn Reddy, I understand some things, some I don't. But there's one thing that worries me, which I'm just interested to ask Secretary General Fashion. Looking at what is being replaced, you are replacing Act 56 of 1957 with one of 1962 and the one of 1980. So everything is still about 20 years back. Now my interest is related to what Honorable Matilde was asking. It's close to it, but I wanted just to ask, is the bill itself transformational? Is it transforming anything once we are placing things of the past about adults of the past? I'm just interested to know. And if there's anything that is transformational in the bill itself, if you can just indicate, I understand that we have to take it to the provinces. But for instance, say, is it transforming anything? Is it creating a process of access, particularly for the previous disadvantaged people? Or is it about the legal terminology that at times is very difficult to understand? That's my main question. Thank you very much.
Just before, let me also just draw something so that we are not coming back again. These two key offices, the State Attorney and Solicitor General. Solicitor General is supposed to be a state chief legal advisor, but somewhere also supposed to exercise control and supervision. How are they going to snitch? Who is who?
the best is to start would be to answer the question of the speaker through this wheelchair. When he asked the question of what is transforming or transformative about this act, because quite correctly he pointed out that it's a 1957 act and there's been smaller amendments more than 20 years ago. And it's correct that the State Attorney Act is an extremely old act. One of the points that we made in the presentation is that after this amendment, we would want to overhaul the entire act that regulates state attorney. But what is transformative about these amendments that we want to, that we seek to bring about is for the appointment, firstly, of a Solicitor General as the head of state attorney, and for the to empower the Solicitor General to make policy. Firstly, in the current act, we state that one of the consequential amendments that we want to make is that we want to create the post of many state attorneys, because currently there is only one state attorney in terms of the act, which was situated in Pretoria, and the other offices in the provinces operated as branch offices. But over time, and historically, and arising out of need, the state attorney offices in the provinces had, we had appointed persons to head those offices, but they were not necessarily appointed in terms of the act as a state attorney. But they were regarded as state attorney in practice, and in fact, because they control those offices. So developments over a period of time took over the practicalities of what was happening on the ground, and the act did not keep pace with what was going on. So the first step about this act is to correct that situation. The second and very important stage is to create the post of Solicitor General. Now the post of Solicitor General will be regarded as the head of all the state attorneys. He would take control of, he wouldn't necessarily be in control of the Pretoria office and then the branch offices, but he would have overall control of the offices in general throughout the country. But more importantly, this official will be at a high level and will be in charge of, will be in charge of implementing the policy that we also want to put into place. Currently, there are policies that guide the way state attorneys work, and I'm sure, Chair, you may have heard of complaints where people say that the work is not being attended to properly, but I think what has been a very significant complaint is about how the state gives out work to private advocates and whether they are hiring enough PDIs and who is getting the work. While there are policies and practices in place, we want it to be more concrete so that we have better implementation on the ground. So that is the further transformative aspect of this work. And my colleague can add on to that aspect later, but I would just like to go to the first question where you said, can the presentation be made simpler? We will definitely work on that and provide you with a shorter, simpler presentation so that you can then take it back to the provinces. And I think we can do that by tomorrow morning. By tomorrow morning or late this evening, if depending on what time we finish. Then with regard to, so you wanted clarity on the minister, whether he should be in consultation with the Solicitor General or after consultation, and I think there was another question that it would be more constitutionally correct to say that it should be in consultation with the Solicitor General. We considered that, and I think when we were in the portfolio committee as well, the matter was discussed quite at length, and one of the issues that resulted in what's wording the clause the way it is worded currently is that the minister is the overall head of the state legal services. The Minister of Justice is the head of state legal services in the sense of the function that falls within his portfolio. Now, if we say that it must be in consultation, I think we're very mindful of the fact that sometimes if there is slight disagreement on certain issues, you will find that the minister will be impeded in exercising his function, and therefore we want to retain the minister's overall role as the policy head. and that is why it is worded in the way it is worded. That was the nature of the discussion at, in the portfolio committee. And then with regard to what can be delegated and what can't, I'll ask Ms. Porter to answer that one.
Thank you, Chief. Just to also touch on the difference between in and after consultation, as one of the members requested is, yes, after consultation will in our view mean first of all the minister must obtain the views of the other person. Secondly, if you look at the court cases, it will mean that the minister must seriously consider the views expressed by the other functionary, but either the final decision will be made by the minister. Then, insofar as the delegation is concerned, you also raised the question, let us just, by way of an example, try to explain what is meant by the delegation function is and how the rights of third person must be taken into account. Let's say that a person is appointed by the person who has got the authority to appoint person. Now, if that authority is delegated to somebody else and the other person makes an appointment, what we say is you can't just then overrule that other decision because somebody has already been appointed. So we try just to create or provide for that situation that you can't just then recall the decision that was taken by the person who received the delegation because that other person's rights may have been affected. And also what we want to guard against is to say that we deem the issuing of the directives and the standards that the AG must issue so important in as part of the implementation of the policy which is determined by the minister that we don't want the Solicitor General, who is now the overall head, to delegate that function. So then those are the two basic issues that we try to make clear there. Then one of the questions relates to whether this bill will make the office efficient and effective and whether it will address the issue of the previously disadvantaged individuals who are not given briefs and those issues. In responding to this question, I think, Chair, what is key here is that although the Minister of Justice can today issue a policy relating to the State Attorney and the branches of the State Attorney's Office, the key is here that in terms of this bill, the Minister is given the power to issue a policy which will also then be enforceable. And people from outside the public can rely on this policy that the minister will determine in regard to the functioning of the officers with specific emphasis on the briefing of a previously disadvantaged person. In the framework it's indicated that it's not only about appointing previously disadvantaged persons. It's also about what kind of cases are given to previously disadvantaged people, and that is what we're trying through the policy then to regulate, but that will be done through the policy, but at least this bill gives the power to the minister to do exactly that. Then, so far as the budget is concerned, Chair, at this point in time, as I indicated, we are only trying to regulate the appointment of a person, a functionary, and we have money on the budget of the department. We have a vacant post of Chief Litigation Officer, and that money will be used for this purpose. Then there was the question about the link between this bill and the legal practice bill, and I must say that is always a difficult question, but I'll try to ask it in the following way. We must remember the state attorneys will be attorneys in the first place, and to that extent the legal practice bill will be applicable to them in the sense as attorneys they will be subject to the power of, I think they call it, the council. So they will be attorneys. But then, of course, on the other hand, they will be public servants because they are appointed subject to the laws regulating the public service.
The other question was relating to the state attorneys, the magistrates, and whether there's any linkage, because I did speak about the transformation. My reference to the transformation of the judiciary was not in a sense to try and link it to the same or to bring their position in line with that of the magistracy. The point that I wanted to make is to say, when we look at the framework which gives rise to this bill, we're not dealing with the transformation of the state attorney's offices in isolation. We also must look how, in general, the whole administration of justice is transformed. The legal profession and the judiciary. So it was more in within that context that I referred to that. Yes, and then I think, Chair, you also asked a question about this whole, the state attorneys, the solicitor, what will the synergy be about them? And if I can put it in a kind of a structure, the minister will be will supervise and direct the solicitor general. The solicitor general, in turn, will be the head of all the state attorneys, and the state attorneys will be the head of the different offices of state attorney. But then, simultaneously, the solicitor general will also be, strictly speaking, in charge of, although in an indirect fashion, of all the attorneys working in the state attorney's offices. So we have the state attorney's office. There are what I will refer to as ordinary attorneys working there, but the office is headed by one person that's also attorney, but who is called a state attorney. So it's like first the minister, then supervising and giving direction to the SG, and the SG then will supervise and give direction to all the state attorneys, and in that sense also the attorneys working in the different offices. I don't know whether it's something that I've left out.
There are many things from the project, because wherever we are going to get our mandate, that's going to be subject to scrutiny. They fear that the language here might be too complex for the ordinary people to give the provinces the money. But as you, there is a commitment to simplify it, I think the permanent delegates will be able to drive the process. Honorable Gunda, Martin?
No, Chair, there was another question that I think they did not ask the. Can you break down the criteria for us?
Paragraph, I think you referred to 3.2. Sorry that I missed that. What? In 3.2.1, paragraph 3.2.1, reference is made to the appointment of a person who meets certain criteria. But that is, if it's paragraph 3.2.1 that you're referring to, that is in terms of the existing Act, the Act as it stands. It's section 2 of the Act, which says that the Minister of Justice may, subject to the laws governing the public service, appoint as state attorney a person admitted and entitled to practice as an attorney. So I'm not sure whether you're referring to that criteria. But that is as is presently in the Act. Thank you.
No, Chair. Here we listen, I think we agree. I think the point raised by my colleague here around us going down to push, I think it is important that the department be present to assist the process. We just introduce and then deal with everything else.
Yeah, I think that is a must.
And again, I just want to emphasize that we are actually planning from programming side that these bills must be presented to the provinces this Thursday and Friday, this one. So the departments must be prepared, they will be contacted June. But these 2 days I set aside for those, for the presentation, for briefing in progress.
Yeah, correct. Programming shifted. Already we have seen some acknowledgement of progress. You must tell absolute police that the right members will be out. Having said that, honorable member, one, that simplified presentation to members for them to meet. Two, availability of your staff, particularly to go and present with certain delegates. Remember, it's my priority. That's very much important. Yeah, I think that's what I could emphasize. When we put the commitment that late afternoon or in the morning we get a simplified form. So we'll leave with that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Department. Thank you very much, honorable members. May I again this and open another. This one is again.
Paragraph 5 on page 21.
If you said there, the Council for Trade and Services shall establish procedures for rectification or modification of schedules. Any member which has modified or withdrawn scheduled commitments under this article shall modify its schedule according to such procedures. South African commitments under the World Trade Organization, General Agreement on Trade and Services, GATS, and BIT. For South Africa to withdraw from its commitments under GATS or BIT, there must be a sound basis for entering into negotiations with the other parties. A sound justification for this to happen must exist. Grounds for justification could be for South Africa to entrench its national security, particularly as a developmental state, and in the broader African Union context, the potential for private security companies to use its might, knowledge and weapons to destabilize the state, or be used by other agencies or states towards that end. Chair, and I think then we need to take cognizance of the transitional provisions in the draft bill itself. Now, if we go to the draft bill on page 23, and the transitional provision starts on page 22, it's the new section 44A to be inserted in the Act, and specifically subsection 15 on page 23 of the bill. The implementation of section 22C, that is the issue about the foreign investment, with regard to security business that is registered as a security service provider at the commencement of the Amendment Act, must be done in accordance with legislation promoting and protecting investment in the Republic and the Republic's international trade obligations. Chair, so in respect of private security businesses that are registered at the moment when the Act comes into operation, this subsection 15 will be applicable. In other words, there is a recognition of South Africa's international trade obligations. And Chair, in terms of the present situation, the GATS agreements, etc., makes provision for an arbitration. In other words, if there is anything where another partner in that arrangement is not satisfied with how South Africa is dealing with it, it must go on arbitration. And Chair, you will know we also referred to a bill that has been introduced, not introduced, it was published for comments by the Department of Trade and Industry. And the bill is named at the moment as Promotion and Protection of Investment Bill. Now that bill at the end of the day will also deal with the arbitration issue. The proposal in the bill is that the arbitration should not be an international one but a national one. But that bill must still go through Parliament and we recognize that. But what subsection 15 does is to also give recognition to those international agreements and that any deviation thereof will be subject to the mechanisms provided for in those legislation in terms of arbitration, etc. Chair, I don't think it's, we can take that much further at this stage, but it really is not a matter of, as was sort of portrayed in this submission, that it's a sort of a denationalization or nationalization of the private security. There are processes that must follow, etc., in terms of foreign ownership. It's not just a matter of nationalization and taking over there are definite legal processes that must precede that. Chair, that is basically our response on the document. You will see it basically deals with Fidelity, Corporate Services, Security Corps, ADT, Security Guarding, which is put out, but the submission was made on behalf of the European, by a representative of the European Union delegation in South Africa. But Chair, these concerns have been discussed in the portfolio committee as well, with reference to that discussion paper that we have presented to this committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the submission, honourable members. Are we satisfied with what just one clarity on this, very same subject on this topic. All these foreign security countries that is that are politically represented in South Africa, is there a possibility that we know how many the ownership percentage is of the South African Indian companies? If there's any, how many percentage of South Africans own in those private securities companies, foreign private security companies that are in South Africa right now, especially the ADTs and all those, how many percentage has South Africans own of that company? Just a clarification. Thank you.
Honorable
Bishop,
can you
thank you, Mr. Chair. Having a look at the information that has just been placed on the table, it is clear that this information is of great importance and it was withheld. And I would like to be informed as to why and what the reasoning was behind the withholding of these letters from the various embassies. Furthermore, it would be appreciated if I could be enlightened what the influence this new information will have on the bill. If no influence, kindly provide us with a legal opinion. This House has then also been blatantly misled with regard to the erroneous statements that were made by our government officials in media reports stating that 51% ownership requirements reflect similar legislation in the USA. The USA does not restrict ownership of private security companies, as they would then not be in accordance with the General Agreement on Trade and Services, GATT. I would also like to know how the insertion of the 51% local ownership will impact on the World Trade Organization. It is evident that South Africa stands to lose many foreign investments in the future, which will negatively impact on the employment of the environment. I would therefore propose that this bill be sent back to the National Assembly to consider these submissions that have not as yet been considered. Thank you very much.
Chair, I think last time we wanted some clarity as well on us with this comment. Well, when we raise one issue that says all these foreign security companies have started not employing South African foreign nationals because of the cheap labor situation. And that is a security risk to the country. You know, because they carry serious ammunition that is not accepted for the country in all those particular issues. And probably it will be the time to try with that situation at home. Because how is that going to assist, even if we have ownership in South Africa, is it not going to deal with these illegal people that are brought into the country to come and work?
Is there any other question from members?
Thank you, Chair. On the first question, Chair, on the extent of foreign ownership, etc., because there's presently no restriction on that, I understood from CEDA that they cannot provide that information readily. But even if we would look at the memorandum that is before the committee, it said that out of nearly 446,000 security officers directly employed in the private security sector, foreign companies employ around 40 to 45,000. So there is quite an involvement by the foreign ownership in the security companies in South Africa. But yeah, I can't give an exact percentage. You know, this is also on the stock market, etc. It's very difficult to break that down. Chair, on the issue of the United States legal situation, it was pointed out to the Portfolio Committee and in this document that the United States doesn't have legislation in this regard. But on an administrative level, in terms of involvement of private security and especially in the defense industry, there are ways in which they restrict foreign involvement, because it relates to their national security, it relates to their defense institutions and properties, access that they do, etc. So there's on an administrative level, there are steps that they are taking in terms of limiting foreign involvement in the defense industry, which is the same principle that we actually put forward here. The other question that was asked about the employment by foreign nationals by foreign security companies. Chair, you will recall that in the Act as it is presently, there is also not a full restriction, but for a foreign national to be involved in the private security industry, that person needs to get an exemption from the Minister of Police. So whenever a foreign national is employed by any security company and there is no such exemption from the Minister of Police, then there is a contravention of the law which can be prosecuted. Chair, I don't know whether my colleagues want to add to that. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. First, unfortunately, that the representatives of SIL are yet, they were supposed to be here. But just to echo the point that General has made, that SIL from their previous briefing, they don't have any information on their database because there wasn't an obligation with regard to the restriction on foreign involvement. But as indicated by the committee, as they go forward with the bill, they will have to introduce systems in terms of their IT and other mechanisms to provide for that information. Yes.
Okay.
I thought you forgot my name, sir. Sir, I do understand what is being said. When you talk about foreign ownership and employment, I think the department, when they are coming with the bill to us, they're supposed to be realizing that we are creating better life for South Africans. Not in exclusion of other people, but first and foremost, we're talking about South Africans here. So now when we're talking about this ownership, when we come to wait for America to have legislation, we're talking about transforming our own society. Not America, we're not transforming America, we can't wait for the American legislation yet. And we're not talking about American legislation, we must talk about our situation. In relation to WTOY, do agree, I do understand that when we do the things, we have to look until at the protocols too, and where I mean, we belong as part of the global world. But for the department, not to assist us, because these are proposals that are coming forward, that the ownership is 1% must go to South Africa. And even in those proposals, it's clear that even if you are talking about that, because of the situation already in this country, it could be very difficult. But it could be done. Among the time, the partners are always telling us about if we find a way in regulation or in something else. And then we realize after 5 years that no, those regulations or what we are testing has not done what we wanted. Our fear is to come and transform the situation. So they must assist us. They can't always be referred to America or anyone else. We are doing things here because we are helping South Africa. And two, on this issue of employment, I can't understand that the police don't know who's working in the security, in the private security company. You can just go down this street now. I can go down this street here and take down with this wheelchair the whole day, and I'll come here and help in all these companies. That through and through, there are no South Africans working. I mean, if they are there, there are 201 working in this security company. Is that the situation in Africa or in Europe or in America or Asia, where the people of the country are not part of such a crucial component of their kind of territory? You will never find it. If you want to go and make a research, I mean, we can't wait for researches yet, because it's going to shift back to us, the thing of being told that America is not doing it like this. But when we're in Germany, we can see what is going on in Germany. When we are in Uganda, we know we can see what is going on in Uganda. When we're in Sweden, you see what is going on there. And when we're here in South Africa, South Africa wants to go and invest there. Invest in partners. Because it's you who's accosting us here. We end up agreeing on things that come back tomorrow and haunt South Africa. I would love to place us the department. They must assist us on the thing. This thing of ownership is critical to us. It's about economic transformation. It's about including people that have been excluded. Those South Africans are slaves in their own hands because these companies are owned by foreigners. I mean, please, let's find the way, let's negotiate. We are not saying take the things, we are not saying take the things from the foreigners. Let's negotiate and find a way of ensuring that South Africans, they own, because this is the wealth of their own country. Please, I mean, it's very well mentioned if we hear the department referring us to America or Britain or wherever. I don't want to refer to any place. Here we're talking about South Africans who are trying to change, transform their own lives. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, it's just a clarity on what I've asked. I think, Chair, how can the department say to us this morning there is no obligation to find out in private securities how many South Africans are working there? How is that possible? Private security companies are a serious, serious company. And we don't know how many South Africans are working there. We don't even know how many foreigners are working there. That's unacceptable. I just want to make an example. When we landed in Dubai, I was nearly locked up because of the security system. When we came to America, we were searched as if we were criminals. But when these people landed here in Owa Tambo, they've been treated like kings and queens. We can't have such a situation. It's unacceptable. There's foreign companies here, private security companies. You don't know how many of the Africans work there. You don't know what type of security they're giving to this country. Because they know the Africans. I will appeal to this, you know. I don't like the Australians, but I admire them for the safety that they have and for their country. Why don't we have South Africans in top security companies? So we don't know who are the DGs and the DDGs of ADT and all these companies. You go down to certain companies here in Cape Town, even in Abidjan. This is the language that the person speaks to you, say to you, this man is not from South Africa. And that's why some of them are so rude to our people, because they don't understand our culture. They don't understand our tradition. But yet we must look to foreigners in our own country. I can't be a slave forever in my own country. I can't. It's unacceptable. As I said the other day, whether people like it or not, we can't be just workers in South Africa. We must start becoming owners in South Africa, because this country belongs to us. Please, can you give us, as South Africans, at this committee, can you give us that, even if it takes you 2 weeks, just give us the percentage of South Africans in foreign private security companies. The NCOP is here until the 28th of March. You can bring it to this committee. We would love to have that before we go on campaign. Thank you.
Honorable Bridget, my dear.
Honorable Chair, I'm back on it. We as South Africans are part of a global, of the whole world. And I'm not sure that these letters that we received from the embassies was discussed in the portfolio committee. And I think that did they apply their minds, what is the influence of this bill to the international world? And I would like to request that we, what did the portfolio committee think of this whole thing?
Just before. Yeah, I'll give you a chance. I just want to remind that we should not forget those things that we said the department must come and clarify, those issues that were requested on the meeting of the 5 February 2014. If we could also not forget them, because that was the mandate why we wanted to meet. Yeah, it's a good one.
Chief, can I refer to this letter? Well, when we met with the British consulate, they told us that the letter, but they're not sure they can give up this letter as a committee. They must first go back and consult. Hence, this letter only arrived after we sent it after our committee meeting, you know. And that's why we did not take into consideration the issues in the letter, because the letter was not before the committee then. That is the situation. They had to go and consult first, because they're not sure whether they can give us this particular letter. But we met with them. That is the situation.
Chairperson, I think we're just wasting our time that we're talking about letters from other countries and so on. This bill was presented to us. We went to the provinces. The provinces sent their mandates. What we are talking about now is what came after we had briefed the provinces. This, yes, it's something that we can just communicate, but it doesn't have to affect our work as a select committee in the National Council of Provinces in South Africa. Maybe the advice that is given can be communicated to the minister's office just for sharing information, but let it not affect our work here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm trying to simplify the way what our members want us to go from here. Can members come out here? What do we want us to go now?
I'm not sure as to whether we need to adopt this now because we've received the comment. If the process is for us to adopt it, let us do that.
Can I allow Patricia also to remind you of the issue that we sent the department?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do we have those issues? Okay.
Chairperson, the first issue was the reference to Parliament in the bill. Section 20 states that regulations must be submitted to the National Assembly. It's proposed that the reference to National Assembly should be changed to Parliament to ensure that the Select Committee also considers and approves such regulations. Chair, maybe our colleagues from the State Law Advisors can assist in this regard. We did use other legislation as well as a model. Where the National Assembly is referred to, but I would just ask that they give their input on that issue as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank
you, Chair. Chairperson, why do I think really guys who considers what is tabled in Parliament, White House considers what is tabled in Parliament, Chairperson, would be how the bill is tabled. Usually the bill is a section 7.
then the process will usually be that the National Assembly considers those documents that are tabled in Parliament. So if it was a 76 bill, then both houses of Parliament would be required to consider the regulation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The next one is the date in the short title should be changed to Private Security Industry Regulation Amendment Act 2014. Chair, we are in agreement with that because of the fact that we have gone over in the next year now. The offences and penalties. The bill refers to a contravention of the regulations. This should lead to a contravention of the Act, alternatively Act and regulations. Chair, I must just point out that in terms of the section that deals with the regulations, there's a separate paragraph that deals with the contravention of the regulations. Of course, there's also in the Act, there's a substantive part that, which refers to contraventions of the Act, which are criminalized. But this particular section only refers to the regulations and in terms of the offenses that can be established for the regulations. So my opinion is that we need not change that. It is correct as it is in the bill. Chair, the period of 5 years, the committee indicate, portfolio committee indicated that we should make that 5 years in terms of the seriousness of the offence. Of course, you would appreciate that regulations, the contravention of regulations normally is less serious than other offences because it's more in terms of the regulatory regime than crimes. But it is a crime to contravene a regulation, but that was the recommendation from the portfolio committee to make it 24 months, to increase it from 24 months to 5 years in order to ensure that the contravention of the regulations is dealt with more seriously by the courts. Chair, the powers. Sorry, Chair, I received this and I just now, so I'm just quickly scanning through it. Chair, then there's a question on page 2 on the operationalization of the Levies Act. Will it not be a solution to solve CERA's funding issues as it will compel security businesses and members to pay the prescribed levies? Chair, of course, the putting into operation of that act, I think, will solve a lot of the financial issues relating to the financing of CERA. You will realize that in the draft bill, it is said that parliamentary approval of funds for CERA can, as an exception, be approved, but that will be only when it is necessary. So it is not an automatic that Parliament will approve money for CERA. They will have to make out the case that in terms of their present financing, after the Levies Act has come into operation, that they cannot operate without it. So parliamentary funds is not a given. It is a possibility after proper motivation to Parliament. The references to South African Police Service, Section 38D makes reference to the Municipal Police Service and this service. Of course, this service refers to the South African Police Service as such and the Municipal Police Service to the Municipal Police Service Chair. Then the alternative that's proposed is that the definition of the service is deleted and that the term South African Police Service is used in full in the book. Chair, maybe the State Law Advisors can advise us on that one as well. I don't think there's really a big difference between the two choices. If I can just ask my colleague to assist me.
Thanks, Chair. The definition of the chapter is an existing definition that is there in the Principal Act. as it is now. So it doesn't change the ministry person. It's defined, service is defined from in the South African Police Service. There's no commission created by that definition, chairperson. So I think it should remain as it is. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, the last question relates to the dispute mechanism that's established through the Minister. Chair, this was also modelled on other legislation, for example, the DPCI legislation, where the minister can assist when there's a dispute between the head of the DPCI and the national commissioner in terms of budget, etc., where the minister is then used as the as a mechanism in order to solve the dispute. And I think, Chair, in terms of the position of the minister having sort of oversight over the private security industry, I think it's also the correct route that's been proposed in the book. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member, prestigious yours. What I've seen, I will approve, I will check, I will dream all sorts of things. Your power, Honourable Brooke.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I must apologize for having referred to the Bill as a 76. Remember, I'm just new in here. But what is important is that what the Select Committee is dealing with, let it be dealt with. Let's not be held to ransom by other things. Secondly, just proposing that we adopt this bill with the explanation that we have got from the legal advisors that we are satisfied with, and do we. That's my proposal.
That is the proposal, and second?
Chair, a second.
Honorable Matthews, not any objection? No objection? Is there another commission
I don't understand how it works.
Can we adopt the bill before we take it to the provinces? Can we?
It's a little bit bad.
We have to do this in 75 years.
Yes. Thank you. My dear Secretary, no objection. The bill is adopted. Can I then read the Select Committee's report on the delegation? A report of the Select Committee on Security and Personal Development on the Private Security Industry Regulation Amendment Bill 27B-2012, National Assembly, Section 35, dated 4 March 2014. The State Committee on Security and Constant Development, having considered the subject matter of the Private Security Industry Regulation Amendment Bill, Bill 27B-2012 of National Assembly, Section 35, referred to it, report that it has agreed to the bill without proposed amendments. Is the true reflection of the decision? Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. You're just arriving in court. That's now. Commission.
Principle and Judicial Matters Third Amendment, Section 76. So we're just waiting on the final mandate to come, and then we'll know by the afternoon, the evening meeting.
Thank you.